You ever watch this guy on television?
You all were not telling the truth, and you should not be trusted.
Congressman Matt Gaetz, thank you for what you did for your country tonight.
Be offended with the Democratic whip, not House Republicans.
Like a machine, Matt Gaetz.
Welcome to Hot Takes. I'm Congressman Matt Gaetz. Let's talk about the news. Judge Sullivan, in his maniacal pursuit of General Flynn, gets a win with the appellate court. The court sitting en banc says that it's okay for Judge Sullivan to appoint an amicus to argue that the government's motion to dismiss should not be granted, that the executive branch of government, represented by the Department of Justice, should not be able to have discretion in the execution of the law. This is deeply troubling because the Constitution constrains judges. It doesn't allow them to make the law, and it certainly doesn't allow them to go out and prosecute cases. They sit as a jurist, as a reviewer. And so allowing the court to essentially maintain a prosecution that the executive branch no longer wants to maintain is just a massive power grab by the judiciary. I spoke about it last night on Sean Hannity's program. Take a listen.
This Flynn ruling should really worry all Americans, no matter how they feel about Michael Flynn. It is a power grab by the judiciary. You should only be prosecuted if the executive branch wants you prosecuted, not because some judge is out there crowdsourcing a prosecution. That is totally outrageous.
Also on the Hannity show, we discussed the decision by Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe not to continue the briefings that were resulting in massive leaks to the United States Congress. Here was that discussion.
Your take on Adam Schiff, because we know he lied through his teeth. We know he leaked repeatedly, and what he leaked was a lot more lying.
I would not trust Adam Schiff with the secret ingredient to my mother's lasagna recipe, much less our nation's most sensitive intelligence. But this dispute is not really about intelligence. It's about politics. You see, Democrats want to use these briefings as a platform to try to scare the American people about Russia, when we know the real threat that we face is from China. And the Democrats know that Joe Biden has a big China problem. If we're going to rebuild this economy after coronavirus, we need a president who's willing to confront China. That's what Donald Trump has done. And if you're just a regular American wondering how all this affects you, you know, the Democrats are saying Russia is the biggest threat. The Republicans are saying that China is the biggest threat. Go look around your home. How many products there are made in Russia? Not too many, but a whole lot are made in China. And so this is all about making sure that you keep the establishment in power through Joe Biden to bolster the phony threat of Russia and diminish the very real threat that China poses.
Congress should get briefings from the executive branch. Congress should also be worthy of those briefings and capable of not leaking sensitive intelligence information. But I think I laid it out correctly on Hannity. The Democrats know that Joe Biden has a big China problem, and so they are looking for any platform, any opportunity to go and accelerate the threat of Russia beyond the real threat that we see in China. And by the way, like, this is not detached from the themes that resulted in General Flynn set up. You had Ambassador Grinnell, when he was the acting DNI, releasing information proving that Mike Flynn was set up and that the conversations he was having largely have proved to be correct. Russia's a declining power, commoditized economy, a demographic tailspin they find themselves in. Meanwhile, China sees their share of the global economy growing. They're becoming more aggressive militarily. They're engaging in election interference. And I think that it's about time that we give the boomers their foreign policy back on Russia and realize that for millennials and for Gen Z to be successful, we're going to have to beat China, and that election interference by China in favor of Joe Biden would certainly be something as worthy, likely more worthy, of our intense defense than, you know, whatever it is Russia's doing. I mean, the best proof you need that the Russian election interference thing was largely about politics, not about election integrity, is that there has been no, like, you know, even request for the 13 Russians to show up that Robert Mueller indicted. I said at the time that was a ghost indictment. That was not an indictment about holding people accountable. It was largely a press release, and that's what it's turned out to be. The Mueller investigation didn't result in the, you know, conviction of a single Russian. And it's not even like they've attempted that prosecution in absentia. There's just been no appearance, no conviction, no nothing. That was all about press. It was all about politics. And it circles back to this decision that D&I Radcliffe made now that we don't want to again start that cycle of politics. Let's allow the intelligence professionals to work hard on resilience. I know that Homeland Security, the FBI, our U.S. attorneys, they're briefing our elections officials on the threats directly so that we can harden our systems, ensure that we've got good online hygiene, that people are not vulnerable to the type of spear phishing attacks that impacted Florida in our elections offices in the last election. So the best way to be resilient is not going out there and trying to fan the flames on the embers of the Russia threat. It is to, in fact, make ourselves stronger and tougher so that China is not able to interfere in our election. They are the true threat. Marijuana reform will see a vote on the floor of the House of Representatives, according to Democratic Whip Jim Clyburn. ABC News' Meredith DeLiso has the story. And I am, I believe, one of the only, if not the only, Republican co-sponsor of the MORE Act. I want to break through what the bill does, but I also want to talk about the politics of the reform movement more broadly, because ultimately, you know, if you have a vote on the floor of the House and there's no action in the Senate, you don't really get the chance to change anything. So we'll look at what the options are for the marijuana reform movement to actually make some progress. And by the way, I believe in cannabis reform in this country. The federal government has lied to the American people for a generation about cannabis. They said it couldn't possibly be medicine. That's not true. We are seeing medical applications of cannabis that are helping people live better lives. The federal government also told us that, you know, this was more going to be more dangerous than all these other types of drugs that were out there, that it deserved to be a Schedule I drug. That is the schedule, the listing of the drugs that are, like, you know, the most dangerous, the most addictive, the most damaging to people's health and people's lives. And now we come to learn that the federal government itself owns patents on marijuana. And, you know, it is crazy that it is more difficult to research marijuana in this country than it is to research cocaine. But that's a consequence of these antiquated dogmas. So what are we going to do about it? The MORE Act. First, it removes marijuana as a Schedule I drug. That is absolutely a step in the right direction, something I completely support. It also, I think, does a lot of criminal justice reform around those convictions that ravaged certain communities. And I'm speaking of communities of color. I think the war on drugs was uniquely harmful to urban communities, to communities of color. And I think that some restorative justice for people that saw just extended convictions or that are currently serving extended time in prison ought to be visited through legislation. So I support that. The third part, this is where we get to a real, I think, rub with, you know, doing a little too much. They've got money generated from marijuana taxes and revenue essentially being used as reparations for communities of color. And I just don't think that that is the way that we ought to stand up industries in this country, that they have to owe some, like, debt to a particular community. And I get it. I mean, a lot of folks in the Congressional Black Caucus, they see marijuana as a substance that ended up with a lot of black kids getting thrown in jail and now a bunch of white people getting rich off of it. And they resent that. But that is no reason to, like, create this whole system of redirecting funds as reparations when really that could fund more research into better medical applications. That could fund distribution that would allow more people who need marijuana as medicine to be able to receive it. If you put that drain on the business, and if you frankly redirect the tax assets away from some admitted costs that will rise. I mean, look, you do need more security, more law enforcement in places where you've had recreational legalization of marijuana. And that'll, of course, always be a state decision. But when you've got the federal government pulling the strings to such an extent as to literally be like reparations, I think that you have departed from the core mission of the marijuana reform movement, which is to kind of get rid of these old antiquated, scientifically incorrect dogmas. So on balance, I think that those frustrating elements of the reparations are less troubling to me than the status quo on marijuana, which is indefensible, really. It's the federal government not even allowing states to be the laboratories of democracy, to try different things, and then to see their, you know, marijuana businesses able to access, you know, just the same financial institutions, the same tax laws. I mean, should a marijuana business really get zero ability to deduct expenses like any other business in America? Should a marijuana business have to operate such an extensive portion of what they do in cash because they can't utilize regular banking? I mean, if we want to be a serious country, I think we need to wake up to the fact that that is an unserious dynamic to try to maintain. So I'm going to vote for the bill. I've been a sponsor of the bill. I think we need marijuana reform. Here's the real problem, though. There is a bill that, if we put it on the floor of the House and the Senate, enjoys the support of most of the membership, and I believe the president would sign it. The president has even said he would sign it. It's called the States Act. And instead of doing all the, you know, restorative justice and all of the reparations, it just does essentially the work of getting rid of the federal government's role in this process, that this will largely be a state-based decision. And if a state does decide to use this under a medical platform or even an adult use platform, that they would have the opportunity to do so without being in like a direct conflict with current federal law on marijuana. So we'll take a vote on the MORE Act. I am disappointed that we can't get a vote on the States Act, because I think that enjoys far broader support and could actually go into law. But yet again, it looks like Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats would rather have the issue than have the progress. They did the same thing on police reform. You know, we had Senator Tim Scott's bill that would have passed, that would have improved policing, but they didn't want that. They wanted the issue. And on marijuana, we have the States Act, sponsored in the Senate by Senator Cory Gardner. It would pass. It would get signed into law if Nancy Pelosi would support it. But instead, they'd rather have the issue. And so thus, that's the behind the scenes on why we'll be voting on the MORE Act. But those who are actually eager to see some progress on marijuana reform, I think, can still blame Nancy Pelosi for not putting legislation on the floor that enjoys broad support in the country and broad support in the Congress and even support from the president in the White House. Is there going to be a new big player in the cable news scene? That's certainly what WGN hopes. They've got the Nexstar Media Group, based out of Irving, Texas, now announcing the launch of News Nation, a nightly 3-hour national primetime newscast. It's going to start at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And here's the argument from Mr. Compton, Sean Compton, who's their executive vice president for WGN America. That right now you've got Fox News on the right, you've got CNN and MSNBC on the left, and they want to offer straight news down the middle. And I take some exception with what Sean Compton says in the Los Angeles Times when announcing this new programming feature of WGN America. He says, "Sean Hannity is not news. He is a friend of mine. I worked with him in radio for years. He'd get mad at me for saying that, but it's true. Tucker Carlson and Don Lemon, that's not news." Here's my hot take. On Sean Hannity's show, we are the news. We're often the ones driving the discussion, the conversation. We're, I think, really telling the truth to the American people, especially during the Russia hoax, about who the criminals are and what the setup is meant to achieve. And that was the destabilization of the Democratic election that resulted in Donald Trump's presidency. So shots fired from Mr. Compton at Sean Hannity. I actually hear on background that they're pretty good buddies. But WGN positioning to be that down-the-middle, nightly, 3-hour news. We'll see how it goes. As trash piles up during COVID-19, residents raise a stink. The Wall Street Journal's Scott Calvert has the story. Americans stuck at home are creating more trash, and some cities can't keep up. The story goes on to talk about Philadelphia and Baltimore being the hardest hit cities, but also places like Nashville, Atlanta, Virginia Beach, Virginia, New York City, municipal governments having a hard time adjusting to the fact that people are creating trash in different places. Here's my hot take. Trash collection is like basically one of the principal reasons why we have local government. And if they're unable to be sufficiently nimble to deal with the creation of trash in different places, it only highlights how uninnovative and slow government is in response to changing conditions in human life. And I would argue that it justifies maybe a greater embrace of libertarianism, personal individual responsibility, and getting more of our own stuff done and working with each other to do so, and not being overly reliant on government. I mean, I don't want to make too big of a point of really just a small change in life as a result of coronavirus, but we're not creating more trash as human beings, right, throughout the day. It's not like we're trashier because of COVID. It's merely like instead of being at an office complex or at a restaurant or at a bar, we're at home a little bit more. And the inability, I guess, to see that, plan for it, be ready to respond to it in some of the places that are mentioned in this Wall Street Journal story, I don't know. Maybe it shows that government isn't always the leading thinker, the leading innovator. We need to look more into ourselves and into the possibilities for the future that we can create to live better lives. There is a fascinating study at Revolver News regarding the number of life years lost as a result of lockdowns following coronavirus, and then comparing the life years saved from those lockdowns to the lockdowns, you see a true indictment of these lockdown policies. The headline from Revolver News, Revolver exclusive study, COVID-19 lockdowns over 10 times more deadly than pandemic itself. And it goes through this study by Abel Sumner, Jeremiah Jackson, and Jacob Cage, where they broke down lives, not in terms of just are you breathing or are you not, but in terms of the overall life year. So if, you know, if someone is, you know, 91 and they die of coronavirus, they likely didn't lose as many life years as someone who might die as a result of like a drug overdose at age 33 that might have had a longer projection on life if they had like a drug overdose that may have been exacerbated by coronavirus. So it is a very interesting and I think unique way to look at the issue and dissect the data, just not in terms of life, but life years. And here's the top line analysis. We found that an estimated 18.7 million life years will be lost in the United States due to the COVID-19 lockdowns. Comparative data analysis between nations shows that the lockdowns in the United States likely had minimal effect in saving life years. Using two different comparison groups, we estimate that the COVID-19 lockdowns in the United States saved between 0.25 to 0.75 million life years. So lockdowns saving, you know, at the high end, 0.75 million life years, costing 18.7 million life years. Check out the study at Revolver News. Great American innovator Elon Musk is one step closer to connecting a computer to your brain. Vox's Rebecca Heilwahl has the story, and Elon Musk has apparently got a pig named Gertrude with a neurochip affixed to her brain and is able to sense and receive information from the pig. So, you know, the presumptive chip that you would have to insert, according to the Vox article, would come with its own way to drill it into your skull and affix it to your brain, and likely would have the ability to engage in these sensors. So they're not at clinical trials yet. Musk says that where they are with animal trials certainly means that they're accelerating and hopeful that they will get clinical trials soon. Check out the article and wonder, would you let Elon Musk put a computer in your brain? I don't know. I probably wouldn't. Let me know what you think. Man's best friend getting the job done in India. Prime Minister Modi giving special thanks to dogs Sophie and Vida as they get Army awards for sniffing out explosives. Both dogs got the Chief of the Army Staff Commendation Medal from the Indian Army, Sophie detected an accelerant which could have been used to make an explosive device, while Vida sniffed out the presence of five mines and one grenade buried underground. Congratulations, and it's great to see the capabilities continuing to improve and demonstrate excellence with our great ally, the largest democracy in the world, India. Thanks for listening to Hot Takes. I'm Congressman Matt Gaetz. Stay safe, wash your hands, give us a five-star rating or a review, and make sure to subscribe and tune in tomorrow for more Hot Takes.